Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke. This is the November 10th, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this beautiful fall day in Central Florida as we spend another hour in conversation about our nation's space program. Today we're going to be joined by two people who share the wonder, excitement, and history of spaceflight, but they accomplish this working jobs that have them very much behind the scenes and for which they will be honored this week with the prestigious award presented by the National Space Club Florida Committee. We'll talk to Sid Champagne of WFTV Channel 9 and Emily Perry of the Air Force Space and Miss Museum about what they do, how they do it, and why the space program is so interesting to them. We'll also catch you up on what's been happening in space and check in on when the next launch from Cape Canaveral will be. Here's a hint. The story hasn't changed too much since last week. Plus, we'll wrap up the program with Terminal Count, our new feature intended to learn something more about our guests while also filling 5 minutes of airtime. And gosh, if that weren't enough, your questions or comments about anything having to do with our space program, also welcome at any time. Feel free to join us on the air by dialing 321-768-1240. Or if you'd prefer to send us an email, the address is spacetalking@aol.com. Okay, let's get started then with this week's installment of our broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. As a lifelong fan of the Minnesota Vikings, an NFL team that has been to the Super Bowl 4 times and never won the big one, and a team that is well known for looking good and scoring well early in the game, only to fall behind and give it up to lose at the end, I was very well emotionally prepared for the outcome of the presidential election this past week. While I was never really happy with Governor Romney's campaign rhetoric related to the space program, or the way his campaign was executed in general, my own worldview and beliefs are more aligned with the Republicans, and, well, that's the way I voted on Tuesday. My sole vote for a Democrat went to Senator Nelson, in part because I believe we still need his leadership and seniority in the Senate when it comes to space-related issues, in part because I was truly unimpressed with Congressman Mack, but mostly because I have known Senator Nelson for a very long time, and sometimes you have to vote for the better man than to blindly follow the party ticket. So anyway, in case you missed it in the news this week, the voters did decide to give President Obama another 4 years to straighten out the mess we're in. At the same time, the House of Representatives retained its Republican majority, and in the Senate, the Democrats will stay in control there. While political analysts from both sides of the aisle dig into the numbers and exit polls to see what can be learned, many in the space community who worry about such things already are anticipating what all of this will mean for NASA and all of those who work to seek and do business by launching rockets and spacecraft from Florida's Space Coast. As a result, for what it's worth, here are some random comments and predictions for your consideration. First, Charlie Bolden will remain as NASA's administrator, and I think given the results of the election and the budget environment the space agency will find itself in during the next few years, it's a good thing Charlie remains at the helm. Being NASA administrator is a thankless job and a tough position to fill when there is a vacancy. If we're not going to change presidents, then there certainly is no reason to change NASA administrators. Second, keep an eye on the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee to see who will replace Representative Ralph Hall as chairman. This is the committee in the House responsible for setting NASA policy. Of course, the White House and the Senate have a say, too. Now, 3 House members who already are committee members are now vying for the job. Representatives from California, Wisconsin, and Texas are candidates for the Republicans to consider. each have interesting backgrounds and histories related to their work with the committee and their relationship with NASA, and each have their own nuances as to their views on space policy. I'm not sure which of them would be the most ideal leader, but all of them will find it a difficult road ahead dealing with a White House and Senate led by the Democrats. Third, expect to see in the weeks to come much more advice offered and even more direction given about our human spaceflight program as to specific missions and destinations for the Orion spacecraft and space launch system. Already there is a growing buzz about NASA soon announcing plans to go back to the moon, plans that some news accounts claim already are approved by the White House but were being withheld pending the outcome of the election. We've also seen reports in recent weeks about an emphasis on establishing a small space station at a place in space called L2, one of 5 points where the tug of gravity between the Earth, Moon, and Sun balances out and a spacecraft can, well, sort of just hover there. The benefit of a place like L2 is that it is relatively easy to get to while remaining relatively close to home, a place where we could learn to operate in deep space before heading further out. Now, a large segment of the activist pro-space community has been screaming to hear more about concrete plans to go somewhere ever since Orion and SLS were announced as giving us the capability to visit an asteroid sometime in the next decade, possibly to Mars around 2035. However, without a specific stated destination, many say the work on new spacecraft and rockets means nothing. Underscoring that sentiment is that with limited funds, NASA is barely able to afford work on Orion and SLS, and even then, only at a snail's pace. The space agency has been given no additional money to develop and fly actual missions made possible by the new spacecraft and heavy lift rocket, while also having to operate the space station and pursuing its robotic space exploration. Unfortunately, I agree with the conventional wisdom that says there will be no new additional money for NASA during the years to come, and the space agency will have to get along with a flat budget while being asked to do all these things anyway. Such an unsustainable path only leads to more delays as programs are stretched out or canceled altogether. Fourth, watch as the emerging private sector of new space, represented by companies such as SpaceX, Sierra Nevada, Blue Origin, and even Virgin Galactic, continue to move forward with their plans to open up the final frontier to anyone who can afford it. As our nation's post-election space policy evolves during the coming months, I believe we'll see even more pressure for the government to turn away from the old way of doing things and seek out the services of these aerospace entrepreneurs for more than just help ferrying cargo and astronauts to and from the International Space Station. Now, whether or not any of that will actually happen, for example, canceling the Space Launch System development in favor of buying rides for Orion on a Falcon 9 Heavy, well, we'll just have to wait and see. All will depend on how successful these companies can be or continue to be during the next few years. There's a lot to be said for the promise of this new commercial space world, and certainly SpaceX so far has put their money where their mouth is, so to speak, and made a good show of it. But I think there are way too many of my fellow space cadets out there who are way too willing to embrace new space way too quickly just because it isn't NASA. Finally, of course, it will be up to our reelected president and his administration, working with the competing ideologies of the Republican-led House and Democratic-led Senate, to take all of these variables, establish a vision for going forward, and plot any changes to the course we're now on with our space program. The one thing I am sure of following the results of this past Tuesday is that you better strap yourselves in, folks. It's going to be a bumpy ride. And that's this week's Orbital Inclinations. Well, when we come back from our first break just about to happen here, we'll hear from a pair of soon-to-be award-winning professional space communicators and discuss their roles in telling the space story here in Florida. Sid Champagne and Emily Perry join us in just a moment. I'm Jim Bankey. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com.
If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. 321-768-1240 is the number to call to participate in the program today. You can also send your questions or comments in an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, you know, it takes people with all sorts of talents to make our space program successful. Scientists, engineers, and technicians make the rockets go up, but only if there's public support and money to pay for it all. As we are fond of saying around here, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. Making sure the public knows what we're doing and why is the job of, well, folks like me and my many colleagues and friends who work in public affairs, community relations, news media, and even as museum curators. As a way to recognize the importance and significant contributions of these communications professionals, each year the National Space Club Florida Committee presents the Harry Colcomb News and Communications Award to two deserving people. We'll talk about Harry in a moment. This week's winners will receive their award this Tuesday during a sold-out monthly luncheon of the Space Club at the Radisson Resort at the Port. They're here with me today. Sid Champagne is a veteran news videographer for WFTV Channel 9. And Emily Perry is the longtime director of the Air Force Space and Mission Museum, which is one of Brevard's best-kept secrets. The museum, that is, not Emily. Sid and Emily, welcome to the show today.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Jim. We're glad to be here.
Emily, good luck with your voice today, sweetheart. We know you had laryngitis this week. A great time to get it before you do a radio show. Let's start with you, Sid, just to ease Emily's voice a little bit. Let's learn a little bit more about each of you. Tell us a little bit about your background. Where do you come from, and how did you wind up doing what you're doing today?
Well, it's ironic. I'm from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, born and raised there. Went to LSU and got into broadcasting, interest in broadcasting at a young age. When I was about 9 years old, a neighbor came over and said, hey, there's a new TV station in town. And I couldn't believe that as a young kid there was actually more than two TV stations.
Yeah.
And there was a new station on the air, and that sparked my interest in broadcasting, and I've gone on from there.
And your job as a videographer, a cameraman, a shooter, I mean, all the different nicknames you go by, how did you wind up getting interested in doing that kind of work, and what sparked it all?
Well, I originally went to college to be a sports announcer.
Okay.
Grew up watching a lot of Howard Cosell on television, Brent Musburger, keeping up Baton Rouge, you know, is a hot sports town.
Sure.
When I started taking classes at LSU, shooting and editing, it just fit like a glove.
Really?
It's like I was born with a camera in my hand, and I stayed with it.
And it hasn't stopped ever since. And when did you come to Brevard County?
In 1990.
And for WFTV for Channel 9 originally?
That's correct. 22 years at Channel 9.
Wow, wow. And we'll talk about how it's changed so much. And I know your first launch was what, Hubble? The Hubble?
My first
mission?
Launch was Discovery in October of 1990.
Oh, really? Was that Ulysses, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, I believe it was. Yes.
After the great summer of hydrogen leaks, which you missed apparently. Got to come here and watch it all fly. Emily, you've been around forever, it seems. You and I have been friends for a long time. Talk about how you got to where you are today.
Not forever, Jim. It's only been 18 years.
18 years is a good number of years.
I was born and raised in a little town in Kansas called Prairie Village, Kansas.
I love it.
Don't you?
Yeah.
You think I'm making it up? I'm not.
It's there.
It's there. And I left Kansas City area and came to Florida to go to college at New College of the University of South Florida in Sarasota. And I have a bachelor's degree in social science. Always been interested in history. My previous job was as the associate director of the Florida Historical Society, which is what brought me to Brevard County. And that job ended, and I looked at the opportunity to become the director of the Space Museum. I had a lot of history and a background in history and museum management, but I didn't know anything at all about space.
Yeah.
It's been a learning curve.
The pointy end goes up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it goes
yes.
from there.
Yes.
Well, that's interesting to me because I've gotten to know a few space historians, and some of them do approach it in much the way that I do, I think, in a way that I have been a space cadet my whole life, and so I'm learning how to tell the history, and I've met people like you who are really the history buffs, who know how to do history, how to what's important, and then the topic doesn't matter.
That's right. That's right.
But you've now, I mean, the topic clearly matters to you. You've been here for 18 years. What is it about the space program that has captured your imagination?
Well, I don't know. I guess from a little gal from Prairie Village, Kansas, who didn't know anything about it. It was just literally a new frontier. And when you're interested in something and you don't know anything about it, then the learning comes easy.
Yeah.
And I have kind of been a sponge in the last 18 years and absorbed as much as I can.
And got a first row seat to everything that's been going on out there.
That's right. That's
right. It's incredible.
It's one of the perks of where my job is located.
Both physically and kind of, I don't know what, emotionally, spiritually,
exactly.
I don't know what the word is.
Yep.
Sid, talk about your interest in space. You know, you came here to Central Florida. I don't know if that was because it was the good job or because you wanted to be part of the space program. What was it?
Well, I'll tell you, I was very lucky. I was working in Shreveport, Louisiana in 89, Christmas time, and it was freezing cold. And I know you're from Minnesota, Jim, but
yeah.
I don't like cold weather.
No.
And I saw the weathercast, and they're like, it's nice and sunny in Florida. And a job came open down here, and it was just a blessing.
Yeah.
Rather fortunate that it was a job on the Space Coast covering Brevard County and the space program and in Central Florida, which, of course, as we all know, is a great place to live.
So you come down here as a news photographer and camera in hand, we'll travel. And they say you're going to be in Brevard County, and you probably didn't know how to pronounce it like everybody else when they first come here. And then what? You got a chance to go to the press site, and your clothes started vibrating, and, you know, there
it's
was
just
loud
amazing.
Noise.
Yes, it was amazing. Within 6 days, my first day on the job, I saw a rocket launch, a Delta.
Yeah.
And then a few days later, a shuttle launch. And, of course, as you know, someone new to the area, it's a learning curve. You learn the steps of the space program and what happens, you know, before a launch, the suit up, the walk out.
Sure.
Ingress, and of course, on those days when we sat out there for scrubs, the egress when they
got too many scrubs.
Exactly.
When you came here, had you had any interest in the space program? Were you aware that there was a space program beyond the usual kind of?
Oh, yes, very much so. A family of five, and my brother that I'm closest to in age, Lauren, he had a big interest in the space program, and I can remember in the 70s, mid 70s, he was really into the space Skylab. And, of course, Apollo Soyuz,
sure.
He was big onto that. And one time he actually looked going to work in Houston for NASA. He was into computers at a young age.
Right.
So he spurred my interest in the space program.
Emily, we're the Space Club, of which I'm a board member and was part of the selection committee. You know, we're honoring you guys for what you do. But when we say you're the director of museum, I don't know if people really understand that. I mean, without just reciting your job description, what is it that you do?
Well, it's more of a question of what I don't do.
Yeah, really? All the hats that you wear out there.
I am the director and the curator and provide administrative support to myself.
Right.
I couldn't do it, however, without my cadre of volunteers.
Incredible group of people.
Incredible. About 100 of them. And they do the tours every day, run the gift shop for me, help me design and install and fabricate exhibits that were trying to tell the story of the history of the space program down here, the importance of the military, assured access to space. I do everything from making exhibits to talking on radio shows.
Talking on radio shows. Well, I've seen you see what you do out there, and it really is everything from sitting in the meetings, the unimaginable amount of meetings and paperwork that gets done, to cutting out letters and gluing them onto tag board so you can make a cool exhibit.
Exactly.
I mean, it's really quite the range. And Sid, the same question for you. I mean, I think we all have this idea of what a cameraman does, and we always see stories, especially around hurricanes, you guys getting blown all over the place. But is there more to it than just holding this box on your shoulder and pointing and clicking?
Oh, sure. Sure there is. In fact, my mentor in this business, Tom Haas, former photographer at WRBT in Baton Rouge, he's the one basically that showed me first, you're not just a camera guy. That's what I thought when I had my internship. Okay,
yeah.
You just go out and hold the camera and you edit a little tape. Not with Tom. He would ask questions, do a lot of producing, help the reporters in the field. It's not just a matter of holding the camera.
One of your fellow reporter or photographer is Joe Carroll from Channel 6, recently retired and a former Colcomm, or a previous Colcomm Award winner. You know, I was impressed with him. I've seen him certainly do a lot of reports where you hold the camera up to yourself practically, you know, and are out there reporting too. And Sid, I think you've done some of that too. I mean, how often do you have to be the reporter as opposed to just the guy shooting the pictures?
More often than not, I'm the guy behind the scenes. I will help and aid them. But it's my job to handle all the behind-the-scenes stuff so the reporter can go out and give the best presentation to the public as possible.
And how much do you have to know the story? You got to know which camera angles. You got to know you're hoping the sun angle's right. You're hoping it's in frame all the time. You got to really know a lot about what's happening out there before you can even shoot it.
Right. You got to know how to tell the story visually to the viewers.
And that first time the fast rocket goes lifting off, the sounding rocket, and you got to remember to point the camera up quick because otherwise you miss it. It's all those little tricks of the trade. Sid, when you're out there doing this, I know you've become like us, a space cadet through the years. But as a reporter, Emily and I are not in this mode anymore. We're clearly cheerleaders. We're clearly on top of it. But with about 30 seconds, how do you stay objective when you do this?
Well, you have to. You can't just be a cheerleader for the space program. It's my job to report the issues that involve space travel, the issues here in Brevard County, and you can enjoy something or like something, but you have to report to the public.
Yeah, I remember an old colleague of mine, a mentor, Chet Lunder, used to tell me, you cover space like sports. You love the game, but if the team makes the wrong call, the coach makes the wrong call, you got to call him on it, absolutely. Everybody, Sid and Emily, stand by. Everyone out there, we're going to pause now for our five-minute built-in hold at the bottom of the hour. Get you caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports on this college football Saturday. And then we'll be back with more with our Kokum Award winners for this year. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Banky.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk here on WMMB. Our phone lines and online inbox are open for your questions or comments during the remaining part of this program. The phone number 321-768-1240. The email address, if you want to do it that way, is spacetalking@aol.com. In the studio with me today are the about-to-be award winners of the Harry Kokum News and Communications Award, given out by the National Space Club Florida Committee each year. Harry Kokum was the longtime editor of Aviation Week and Space Technology for a long time, really, and maybe still is the Bible of the aerospace industry in terms of what's going on. Harry was based here in Cocoa Beach for years and years and years and was truly a master and the dean of space reporters and communicators. He was very instrumental in starting the National Space Club Florida Committee many years ago. And after he passed away, the club decided that we would like to honor those who are following in his footsteps and doing the same kinds of things that he did and telling the story in such a professional way. Emily Perry, the director of the Air Force Space and Missile Museum, and Sid Champagne, a news photographer for WFTV Channel 9, selected as this year's honorees, both of them outstanding space professional communicators. And now I've just rehearsed my speech for Tuesday. How does that sound?
Sounds great.
Sounds so good so far. Emily and Sid here in the studio with us, and we're back to talking with them. Sid, I want to ask you a little bit about more about what you do out there, because there is a sense, I think, that people, again, as we kind of alluded to earlier, that you show up before a launch, you unplug the camera from the charger or the cigarette lighter, go out, hit an on switch, hit the little button on your trigger finger, the red light comes on, you shoot some videotape, you put it on USB, and you dump it to a computer, and that's it. You're done for the day. Let's go home. It is so far from the truth of what you do out there. You're really in the trenches as to what happens. Talk about what a day is like to cover a launch.
Sure. But before that, let me say how honored I am to be a recipient of this year's Kokum Award. I was floored when I got the phone call. I thought I was getting a news tip. Someone was calling with a news tip. I'm like, great, there's going to be a new rocket company coming to town. There's going to be more jobs in Brevard County. We're going to have a big story today.
Well, we know how reporters hate to be in the news itself, so the news tip was all about you.
And when I was really taken back. It's a high honor to join you and Joe Carroll and all the other colleagues who've received this award and be this year in the same boat with Emily. That's quite a high honor.
Well, that's great. So talk about your day out there. It's more than just pointing and shooting.
Well, I'll tell you, I described it one time to someone who was coming out for cover their first launch, and I said it's like an LSU football game. You got to know what happens and when.
Right.
When the band comes down to the field, when they march on the field, the national anthem, the players come on the field to practice. It's like that way for a shuttle launch. You got to know when, what happens, and where, and there's a lot of setup involved. Your live truck, a satellite truck. Generally, for a shuttle launch, you'd have an anchor, a reporter, a lot of times coming over from Orlando to help out. You have support personnel coming from the main station. And you could set everything up, be ready to go, and we're scrubbed for today.
That's right.
And yeah. Lights and cameras, and it's quite something.
As a reporter and even as a TV reporter, you know, a lot of times you think, well, you just show up, watch the launch, and leave, and you've been out there for hours already and hours to come. In fact, I wanted to ask you, is it a universal truth? Is there part of a job description that says that the on-air talent has to carry the tripod?
No. Sometimes they carry a lot more. Sometimes they carry a lot less, depending on the situation.
I've seen it both out there, absolutely.
But, you know, the last flight of the shuttle, last shot of the program, we were out there with the exception of an hour and a half to eat dinner, and took two or three people by my house. We grabbed showers, changed, and went back, and we slept in the vehicles all night because we were worried about getting out in time because of the traffic situation.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I've done the same thing, spending nights in the car or the trailer out there. Sid, I do want to touch on, you know, in the package that led to your nomination, there was some folks talking very highly of you about your involvement and help the day we lost Columbia to your station. You were out there at the runway getting ready for it to come home. It didn't. And a lot of people were praising you for that day and the days to follow for your expertise, the institutional knowledge that you brought to the whole thing. I mean, you really do. You're maintaining your objectivity, of course, but you wind up becoming very close to the program, the people, and the events that happen. And I know they took advantage of you. Can you tell us a little bit about that day?
Well, I must tell you, it was a sad day. Luckily, we had extra folks there that day because we had an Israeli astronaut coming back on the shuttle.
Right.
We thought that we might have a last-minute request from one of the Israeli networks for coverage. So we had a satellite truck there, a live truck. I was out there. Cameraman Jeff Taplin was out there. Our truck operator, Bruce Riley. And at that time, Phil Robertson was our correspondent. And Phil and Jeff were up on the old ABC tower, which was a wooden structure that we would use to cover landings. I had just gotten a cup of coffee and had sat down at the IFB center right there inside our satellite truck. I would relay information up into Phil's ear when the calls started coming back that they were having trouble communicating with Columbia.
Right.
And I walked outside the truck and started calling the folks in Orlando to say, listen, we need more help out here.
Because you knew right away. You knew that something was not normal.
Right.
And when you cover things so often out there and you get to know, that's what you get to know. You hear the rhythm, you feel what's going on, and you can immediately feel when something changes. And again, you know, it is part of what you do out there. It's the good stuff and the bad stuff that you see, and we've all lived through that. Emily, let's talk to you about something a little brighter, and that's getting the public out to seeing the facilities out there. We've got a new history center, and I should say by disclaimer that I'm also one of the hats I wear is as the secretary of the Air Force Space and Missing Museum Foundation Incorporated, a nonprofit that supports what you're doing out there. You and I have an official memorandum of understanding between us, don't we?
We do.
How about that?
Yes, we do.
I've never had that with a guest before, so it's kind of fun. But we have the new History Center. Talk about your efforts to get some of what's going on, the story being told in a place where it's beyond the gate so that people can see what's going on out there.
Well, it's difficult to get people on base because it's such a highly secured facility. I will have to say that we offer two public tours that are free every week through the 45th Space Wing Public Affairs Office. And they actually meet at the History Center, which I'll talk about in just a minute. And then the tour is a three-hour tour of the Cape, which includes the actual Air Force Space and Missile Museum, lots of the historic sites, the historic Cape Canaveral Lighthouse, and then ends up at the History Center. We have a driver and a trained volunteer docent that has lots of information, anything you would ever want to know. They can answer all the questions. And those have been very, very popular. You can go to the Patrick Air Force Base homepage and sign up for the tours. Reservations are required.
Right.
And as you can imagine, because of the cost, which is nothing.
Nothing.
They sell out very quickly, Wednesdays and Thursdays, unless there's an operational constraint.
Yeah, they're very popular. And, you know, again, we wish we could do more of them. And that we know that's budget issues and all of that, which is a discussion for another day. But incredible displays and artifacts out there. Talk about some of the things that people can see, not only at the History Center, but if they take the tour and they go out there, what can they see in the museum?
Well, the original museum is a Launch Complex 26, which was deactivated in 1962 and then turned into a museum in 1963. It has all the original launch consoles and equipment. Actually, it even smells a little musty.
Yes, it does.
There's not been a lot of changes to that. It's a step back in time, literally.
Yeah, it really is. The smell of history in there. It really does feel that way. One of my favorite artifacts is out there is the Gemini capsule that flew twice. It was actually the first spacecraft ever to be reused in the history of the United States space program. It flew as Gemini 2.
That's correct.
Unmanned vehicle before Gemini 3 flew with Gus Grissom and John Young back in 1965. And then flew later, and I forget what year it was, but it flew as part of the manned orbiting laboratory, the
MOL,
Titan 3C.
Manned orbiting laboratory.
Yeah, and flew a second time with a hole in its heat shield, basically, to test a hatch or something.
It's pretty incredible to have that artifact that you can walk up and touch and see and take pictures of. And we have photographs on the wall of it on top of each rocket that launched it. Twice. It's the only one that's ever been flown twice, and it's the only one with military markings on it.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. It is, isn't it? Yeah, because it was kind of repainted, if you will, after the NASA flight. Talk a little bit about, Emily, you know, as the history continues to unfold. So as we talk about history out there, we want to think 20, 30, 40 years ago, all the old ancient stuff, missile heyday and all that. But we also have a Delta IV Common Booster Core sitting on display out at the museum. And new things are happening now. So as the new events happen, as launches happen, what kind of eye do you have toward collecting things or capturing that history as it happens to be used later?
I believe you have to have a vigorous collections policy, and you have to not only look towards the past on what we have accomplished and what the vehicles were, but current as well as future things. So we have an exhibit, say, at the History Center that deals with SpaceX, which is our new, with the Falcon and the Dragon capsule. And I'm always raising my hand and telling people, don't throw it away. Don't throw it away. Let me see it first. And I get an awful lot of folks that come in with documents, photographs, artifacts. And if it's appropriate to the collections policy, I'm more than happy to take it and develop it into an exhibit that we can interpret.
And you have quite the personal collection yourself, which we will probably talk about during our terminal account feature. But you've got a new exhibit with about another minute here to go before we take our break here. A new Jetsons exhibit out there, which I think is so cool. I just hear that music playing in the background.
Is boy all right?
That's right.
That's at the History Center, and that's a 3,200-foot square foot facility that we opened almost 2 years ago, and it's outside the gate. It's on base, but it's outside the gate.
Yeah.
So you don't need any badging required to get on the base. It's free and open to the public. And we have special exhibits we put up about every quarter.
Yeah.
Some of them are more serious than others. We just did a Wernher von Braun.
Right, 100th birthday.
Yeah, which is a little more heavy.
Right.
And then we just put up the Jetsons, which is a lot of fun.
That's great. Well, we're going to come back in a moment, get you caught up on the next launch, and play Terminal Count with our guests, Sid Champagne and Emily Perry. We'll be back in just a moment as we take our final break. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Banky.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk with your reminder that you can stay in touch with us online throughout the week. Your first stop, of course, WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, where you can find an archive of past Space Talk shows and text versions of our orbital inclinations. You also can follow us on Twitter at Space Talking. We have a Space Talk page at Facebook as well. Your questions or comments about the program, always welcome. Okay, well, let's check out when the next launch might take place from here on Florida's Space Coast. The situation really hasn't changed since the last time we talked. A United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket is targeted to fly from Complex 41 at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station on November 27th. The booster is to carry the Air Force's X-37B orbital test vehicle into Earth orbit on a mission to test the small-winged space plane. This would be the third mission for the program and the second flight of this particular vehicle that's scheduled to fly. However, as we've been talking about, United Launch Alliance and the Air Force are continuing to investigate why an upper stage rocket engine that is used on both the Atlas V and the Delta IV did not work as expected during a Delta IV launch last month. In fact, a senior Air Force official reported to have said at a conference this week that they're not even close at all to finishing the investigation. So there is some doubt that the 27th will even be possible. By the way, there was some great news from the Navy this week that we can expect to see some more activity at the Cape related to the submarine-launched Trident missile program. The Navy is consolidating some of its test operations here, which will mean more jobs for the area. It actually won't mean more launches, though, at least from the Cape itself. The submarine launches offshore will continue, which is something we usually don't hear about in advance, and which is why we don't announce them. In fact, there was a launch a couple of weeks ago. If you were looking east at the right time, you may have even seen the exhaust plume. Of course, it was a secret launch, so we won't talk about it. Anyway, for more information about this and all the various other launches scheduled around the world, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com, keyword space talk, and look for the link to our launch forecast. Well, in about the 4.5 minutes or so that we have left, it's time for Terminal Count, the new feature at the end of our Space Talk program in which we will ask 5 simple questions of our guests to get to know them a little bit better. This is not a quiz. There are no right or wrong answers. This is not a contest, so please, no wagering. Okay, Sid Champagne, coolest rocket.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I don't know if you'd call it a rocket, but the Space Shuttle. For what it did for this country and space travel, it's reliability, reusability, and all it could do, without a doubt.
Emily Perry, coolest rocket.
Well, you know, I'm a museum curator. I'm into history, so I'm going to have to go with the Navajo.
Navajo.
It's a winged missile. It's at the south gate of Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, kind of serves as a central.
Sure.
To the entrance, and it is a one of a kind.
Oh, it absolutely is, and we want to keep it that way and keep it here.
Hope so.
Absolutely. Okay, Sid, first launch you saw or remember?
The first launch I saw was a Delta, my first or second day on the job, but the one I remember most, to me, in my mind, the height of the space shuttle program was the John Glenn, his second flight.
Sure, that was incredible. Emily, first launch you saw or remember?
First launch I saw was a Delta II from Complex 17, which is located right behind the launch
Stone's
Complex
throw.
26. And we kind of had a love-hate relationship.
That's for sure.
Because every time they launched, we had to close.
Right.
But that was my first launch when I came here.
Oh, that's great.
Delta II.
Sid, most prized space memorabilia.
Well, I must tell you, Jim, I don't collect a lot of memorabilia in my job. You know, you stay away from autographs and things of that. But I did get a coin someone gave me when we did the return to flight mission. And
yeah.
To me, that's just emblematic that the American space program doesn't quit no matter what. When the chips are down,
it
comes back.
Absolutely. And Emily, this is like asking who your favorite child is. What's your most prized space memorabilia?
Well, unlike Sid, I have quite a big collection of space memorabilia.
Huge collection.
And we actually use a lot of the artifacts in the exhibits, which is a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to say that my favorite toy is the first one I ever got, which was from my brother, and it was a metal friction toy with a little astronaut inside.
Oh, really? So you kind of pull it back and let it go, and
let
then the
go.
Astronaut
yeah.
does
and
little things.
And it still works, yeah.
And it still works.
Way cool.
I'll have to see it. I don't know if I know which one that is.
Okay.
Sid, best space TV series or movie?
Live Long and Prosper, the original Star Trek TV series.
Classic. There you go. Okay, and I guess that goes without any additional explanation. Emily, best space TV series or movie?
Well, it sounds like I'm publicizing the History
yeah,
Center, but I'm going to have to say the Jetsons was really, really cool.
Yeah.
And our exhibit is really, really neat,
too. Oh, absolutely.
Got clips on video and lots of memorabilia. Did you know there was a Jetson cereal?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I didn't know. Do you have one?
We have a Jetson cereal box.
Do you have actual examples of it? I mean, like, could you pour it in a bowl and eat it?
No.
Did you bring us any? Yeah, that was my question. It's right. Snack time.
That's right. I've got some old Star Trek cereal the same way that I wouldn't dare want to touch, despite all the preservatives. Sid, I guess we're going to start wrapping up. Sid, Moon, Mars, or beyond?
All three.
All three. He wants his cake and eats it, too.
That's right.
Emily?
I've got to go the same way.
Yeah.
Got to go Moon, Mars, and beyond. You know, emphasis on beyond.
And beyond. Well, see, there you go. I mean, there is such a debate as to how do you get to where you're going and what needs to go first. And someone said back to the moon to get to Mars. Someone said go to Mars direct. Others are talking about asteroids and all that. It's interesting to hear everyone's feelings. And I kind of agree with you guys, too. I mean, we should be able to do all of it, shouldn't we?
We should.
Sid, Emily, we need to wrap up. Thank you so much for being on our program today as a teaser for what folks can expect on Tuesday. Again, congratulations from me personally on your winning the Harry Kokom Award this year from the Space Club. We're going to have a great Tuesday to celebrate what you do. And again, I appreciate each of you being here today. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jim.
Appreciate it.
It's been our pleasure.
Oh, that's great. Okay, well, there they go. We'll turn them off so they can start making noise at me now. Next week on Space Talk, well, we'll start helping you get ready for the holidays and maybe learn something about the space program along the way as we talk to the authors of two different books that I'm very happy to recommend to you and suggest you include on your gift list. Paul Gilbard, I'm going to learn how to pronounce that by next week, is the author of Moon Hoax. It's not what you think. It's a fictional book about a race to the moon with the Chinese. A great read. Had a lot of fun with that one. And also on the program next week, one of my closest friends from college, Brian Nicholas of the National Air and Space Museum, has put together what I think is the definitive book about American missiles entitled, coincidentally enough, American Missiles. So we'll have him on the program to talk about that book. And in fact, Emily, get more into what kind of missile history there is out here at the Cape, because that book covers it as well. Well, that is it for now. Space Talk is a production of Mylas Solutions and is brought to you thanks to the generous help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the op station for today's program. Please join us next Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for another hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now as WMMB presents a weekend edition of the Glenn Beck program. I'm Jim Behnke, and we'll talk to you again real soon.